Good morning, Your Honor. Alan Crowley for the appellants, Wendy Thomas and Union SEIU.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have mics that rise up to somebody of your height. So just try to sort of point them at your mouth and project a little bit.
Okay. Alan Crowley representing the appellants, Wendy Thomas and the Union SEIU Local 721. The appellants have sued to stop retaliation against the union's lead negotiator. That's what the suit was about. We believe there was errors on three parts by the lower court. The lower court applied the wrong standard to analyze many of the adverse actions. There was approximately 30 adverse actions of various levels of severity alleged, and the lower court did not analyze many of them. The lower court wrote, defendants have no obligation to explain away events that are of no legal significance. That's it. Page 32 of the judgment.
You agree that there are certain things that happen in the workplace that fall below the level of an adverse action?
Well,
as a general proposition, you have to agree. I mean, I'm not saying about this, but you agree that some things that...
There is, but the way it's analyzed is whether it has a reasonable effect of deterring an employee from engaging in the things. In the Ulrich versus Los Angeles case, in that case, there was only two allegations. One, that the employer looked the wrong way and verbally assaulted the employee. And that was all the only two allegations. And in that case, the court found those two allegations alone was too low to raise a constitutional issue. But in this case, when we have a whole plethora where the court didn't analyze the removal of teaching assignments, which cost Thomas $9,000 a year, not allowing her to have paid break time between Central Dispatch and BCTC, those are far above the level, and those are part of the campaign of retaliation that occurred over years. But yes, in theory, of course, as it says in the Cozalter versus City of Salem case, the First Amendment is not to be trivialized, but there isn't a bright-line rule. It all depends on the context.
And stuff happens in jobs. People have to be moved around, not everything rises to the level of, you know, if you could make an issue of everything, then everything would become a lawsuit. It would be very difficult to have any control over employees.
Well, of course. I mean, that's, there are many allegations in there. Of course, an employee never knows whether those things are taken for a certain reason, because there's usually a direct statement that an action is taken because of their protected activities. The complaint alleged a whole series of actions from various levels, which they contend and the court contended were somewhat trivial, but the error was that the court didn't analyze many of them, like the removal of teaching assignments, which has certainly cost a lot and affected Ms. Thomas, or others that are far above the standard. And the court did apply effectively a bright-line rule. The court should have looked to see whether those actions reasonably would have deterred a reasonable employee from continuing to engage in activities.
Okay. The court did look at certain major actions.
Yes.
Maybe we should talk about those, and then we can sort of add the...
Okay.
The lesser ones, or the ones that the court thought district court sort of was lesser.
Right. Well, there's many of the only ones that the court looked at. The court looked at eight actions. Six of the ones were actually briefed. Two of them were not briefed by the parties. I think the court.
But they were in your complaint, were they not?
Yes, they were. They were parts of the allegation.
So, and you hadn't withdrawn those allegations.
Right.
So it was perfectly appropriate for the court to look at them.
It was appropriate for the court to look at them, but it wasn't appropriate for the court not to look at other ones that were significant. The court focused
on... Well, that's a different issue, but you...
Yes. Okay. But the ones, for example, that the court did look at, and as we discussed, when you have three internal affairs investigations of an employee who for 13 years has never been investigated, and then she becomes active in the union, and within less than a year and a half, there's three internal affairs investigations... most people would think that would be an issue.
Well, let's take them in order. One was based on a complaint, fairly serious complaint, by a former employee, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
What are they supposed to do? You say, well, she's a shop steward, we can't investigate her?
No, we
can't look into it? I mean,
yes.
And then you get a complaint from another employee saying you looked the other way.
Well, but the... When you have one internal affairs investigation, okay, that's possibly understandable. But when you have three in such a short span of time, that's where the issue becomes. And even with respect to the first one, where it was a trainee who complained, when 90% of the trainees do not make it to the program, and they are routinely, and many of them complain, there's not an internal affairs investigation for a complaint like that. It's the discriminatory application of work rules, which is the issue.
Do we have a sampling of what other kinds of complaints other people have made, other trainees have made? I mean, these seem like fairly serious allegations. I don't know, you say 90% of them complain. Is that in the record?
Yes, it is in the record that between 75 to 90% of the trainees, the dispatch trainees, do not make it through.
But do they complain?
Many of them complain. And there were statements from, yes, in the record regarding from the declaration of Wendy Thomas, who was the dispatch training supervisor, that there were often complaints about the way the training was conducted, but never had a complaint led to an internal affairs investigation. That was, and like I say, it's the sequence of the three of them within the span of a year that was the troubling aspect. The second one, for example, they initiated an internal affairs investigation because she CC'd her attorney after this lawsuit had been filed when she questioned her supervisor about why her pre-approved vacation had been withdrawn when she was involuntarily transferred for the third time. I mean, most workplaces, a supervisor would talk to an employee and say, you don't do that. You don't initiate an internal affairs investigation for CCing an attorney on an email. And so that's the kind of inconsistent application which a jury could say, well, this shows motivation, that the real motivation is they're throwing the book at her, having our sergeants.
Well, on the second investigation, she'd been twice before warned about improper use of emails, right?
Well, there you go. So once was 13 years ago when she was a trainee, but they didn't conduct an internal affairs investigation. The other time was 7 years ago, but they didn't conduct an internal affairs investigation. So why, if the previous times they don't do internal affairs investigations for wrong email use, do they do in the third time?
For the same reasons that sometimes judges will give probation or supervised release on a first offense, and they might not on the second or third offense. I mean, you know, because you figure people who have been warned before should have learned their lesson. I mean, that's not on its face strike me as
Right, but that's an argument that the judge has to make, that the jury should make. We raise the circumstantial arguments, and the jury decides whether it's believable or not. It's not the judge's purview to say, well, I think it makes sense that this email warrants an internal affairs investigation.
And what about the theft of the documents?
Well, it's characterized as a theft of the documents, but that's not what happened. I mean, what happened in the record shows was that she was rebutting an aspect of a performance evaluation, walked into the office that she had just been booted out of, and asked to photocopy documents to rebut her performance evaluation. Again, and the witness that was there next to her wasn't even interviewed, and eventually the whole charge, the writ she was written up for, that was all withdrawn because they realized their investigation was shoddy. Again, it's examples of throwing an internal affairs investigation that are very severe when they wouldn't normally do that. And the reason they do that is because she's the lead negotiator and she's riling the sheriff's department officials.
I have a much more narrow question. Why should we not, even if we otherwise were persuaded by your argument, affirm summary judgment as to MacArthur and, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, Gemend, G-E-M-E-N-D, on because they lack authority to commit the adverse employment actions that you're complaining about?
Well, with respect to MacArthur was the director of employee relations. He was for the whole county. He was one of the highest level officials in the county. And he was the one that, he chastised her for acting as a steward in an email. And saying that if she acts like that, she can lose her job. The threat was there. It wasn't quite that lose her job. But he is basically threatening her for engaging in union activity. He certainly had the authority to make that kind of a threat. So I don't think that's proper. There's a dispute of facts as to whether he has that authority. With respect to Gemendi.
No, the question is what adverse employment action would he have had authority to take against her?
he would have the authority to, as the director of employee relations, initiate any level of adverse employment action. Mm-hmm. It would have to be, you know, probably processed to the sheriff's department. But, you know, and it's not the, I mean, there's no justification for harassing an employee, and it's not the level of the action that's actionable.
And what about Gemendi?
Well, Gemendi engaged in several actions that are in the record regarding, you know, removal of the computer resources, which weren't that discussed in the summary judgment motion because of limited space. And she was Ms. Thomas's first-line supervisor, because there was two levels, there was two supervisors, and took several of the actions, like the removal of some of the computer resources that she needed for her job.
Limited space?
Huh?
Limited space? What are you referring to?
8 days to respond to a summary judgment motion, and so one we make choices as to what we can argue in terms of the evidence.
So you don't mean limited space?
Limited briefing space and time.
Your limited time? Is that what you're referring to?
No, I mean in terms of you can't.
You're saying that you should be excused from raising evidence that is important to determining a particular individual's summary judgment liability because you felt that you didn't have enough time to include it? Is that your argument?
No. We made allegations. We had defendants. And through the course of evidence and the amount of time to respond, we can't include everything and make decisions. Gemendi is probably the defendant who we had the least proof of motivation and that had the ability to engage in the actions, but it was unknown at the time of discovery, which happened and as it coincided with summary judgment, as to whether that level, you know.
So are you still appealing from the summary judgment as to Gemendi?
I would say no, because with respect to Gemendi, but yes, with respect to MacArthur. I only have 3 minutes left, so I think I'd like to reserve some time.
Okay, thank you. Yes. We'll hear from Kevin.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Edward Zappia. I'm here on behalf of defendants, appellees, cross appellants. For this Court's review, what I think is appropriate is starting with the correct order of addressing Monell and qualified immunity. Once those issues are disposed of, no one needs to get to the detailed delineated facts, which, of course, I'm happy to do. But in the Court, in applying Monell and lack of county liability, the county is dismissed as a defendant. Applying qualified immunity to these individuals, to which they're clearly entitled under the law, the most serious allegation against any of the defendants is a employment action of either reassigning the plaintiff or of initiating an investigation based on a complaint.
So what's unclear in the law about not being able to retaliate against an employee for union activity?
There's nothing unclear about that.
So if the allegation, the factual allegation, is that these were steps taken in retaliation, why is qualified immunity at issue?
Because on qualified immunity, you don't just assume that to be true. In this case,
that seems to collapse with the summary judgment inquiry, doesn't it?
No, not on qualified immunity. On the qualified immunity arguments, the public officials are entitled to be completely immune from suit, particularly for actions taken within the ordinary scope of their duties and discretion. In this case, even the allegations, the factual allegations, not the conclusory legal opinions, are that they took mostly relatively immaterial employment actions.
Wait a minute. You say they're immaterial.
Yes.
But... and the district court with regard to the main merits motion, but on qualified immunity, which the district court didn't rely upon, I don't understand the difference. Suppose she's reassigned, let's just accept as a given, which is the allegation, and there's some evidence to support a proposition. She's reassigned from one office to another because her supervisor didn't like all the time she was spending on the union activities. Why would that supervisor be eligible for qualified immunity?
Because under because a supervisor could not be expected to know, especially in a sheriff's department where reassignments and transfers are routine, that simply reassigning or transferring an employee, which is part of their duties and part of the supervisor's customary daily duties, would be a violation.
No, but if they took that action with an intent to retaliate, then they would not be entitled to qualified immunity, correct?
I would agree with that.
So I don't see what's the difference. This is the point Judge Clifton is making. Why is it in this case the qualified immunity issue any different from the issue that the court addressed below? If the court below was right that you're entitled to summary judgment, then there's no qualified immunity issue. If the court is wrong, if a reasonable juror could have found that some of these actions were taken with retaliatory intent, and then qualified immunity would not apply, would it?
Well, if there was proven intent, but again, to your point.
Well, that's the allegation. And you can put events in juxtaposition. If the court can decide as a matter of law there's no intent, that ends it on the merits. But I just don't understand how you say we can start with qualified immunity and not have to get to the merits, because it seems to me, unless there's an unclear proposition of law, in the end it's going to be pretty much the same thing.
Well, I mean, I would agree to the extent, depending
on. Okay, so let's get to the main merits.
Well, but on the main merits, well, two issues. The first is what I think is significant on SEIU's primary appeal issues. This court did exactly what the Burlington Northern Court expressly authorizes and in fact requires. The district court below did review all of the allegations. There's this contention, or at least inference, that it ignored many of the allegations. All of the allegations were addressed in the record. All of the court stated specifically it reviewed the record every single page, and then, as required by Burlington Northern, addressed the materially adverse issues which it made its findings, which may deter a complaint in the future.
So what about the loss of $9,000 for the reduction in teaching?
In that particular one, that would be without question something that might be materially adverse, but there's no evidence the court overlooked or ignored that. The court spent its time addressing those, which, by the way, we seem to all agree were material. SEIU's complaint.
So why, on the one I just mentioned, why couldn't a reasonable juror infer that that was retaliatory?
Well, I don't know what a reasonable juror could or could not conclude, but even
then, shouldn't we have a trial?
Well, no, because when you look at all of the allegations, I think there's no material issue that Wendy Thomas was given all of her rights she requested, all that she was afforded, and the court went to the next step on adverse employment actions. By the way, determining whether something's adverse or not is only the initial step. Even if something is an adverse employment action, the next step is then to analyze whether there was justification and business reasons for the decisions. And in this case, the court addressed those and did find in each instance that there were legitimate business reasons and justifications not related.
Why isn't that a jury issue? In other words, they say that this was retaliatory. You say it was taken for business reasons. They can point to a variety of things, such as timing, that suggests it was retaliatory. You can point to various things that suggest it was taken for business reasons. Why isn't that a classic jury question?
Well, because the evidence, summary judgment, is a full evidentiary motion. By the standard you're implying, it's just if there's an allegation then that gets over summary judgment. And that's not the standard, to answer your question, because the evidence before...
I appreciate you telling me the standard for summary judgment,
well,
but
I should
that's not my question.
Well, to respectfully answer your question, it is because this court reviewed the evidence, and in its review of the evidence on summary judgment, it found the evidence demonstrated that the county had presented justifiable, legitimate reasons for its decision.
But that's not the right standard, is it? The question has to be at the end. If taking everything most favorably to the non-movement, could a reasonable juror, even when confronted with these explanations, still conclude that it was retaliatory? Isn't that the standard?
I don't think that's the standard exactly. Is there a triable issue of a material fact? That's what the court reviews for. It reviews.
Well, how's that different from what Judge Rakoff just said?
Well, the court, because the court...
It's a triable issue if a reasonable juror could make that finding.
If you presume that to be the case...
I'm not presuming anything. I just don't understand what's different between you disagreed with the standard laid out by Judge Rakoff and you told me something that I thought was exactly the same thing. If there's something different, I'd like to know what it is because I'm missing it.
On summary judgment, our contention is the court did exactly what it's required to do. It reviewed the evidence. It reviewed the arguments of the parties. And it made its determinations.
What determination? It's not a determination like a bench trial. It reviewed the evidence and decided that the defendant's case was right. That's not the determination, is it?
No. For
what's the determination?
Well, for example, there were many determinations.
No. I don't need examples. I mean, what's the determination? I think it's pretty simple. I think it's what Judge Rakoff just told you. But you said that's not it, so I want to know what it is.
Well, the determination, for example, one of them, there were many. The determination is... For example, on the first reassignment, Wendy Thomas...
Isn't the determination whether a reasonable jury could make that finding? That's all I want to know. And if it's not, I want to know what it is.
Well, it's my understanding the determination on summary judgment is whether plaintiff has submitted evidence to raise a triable issue of material fact.
Which means what?
Such that it should go to a jury for determination.
Which means what? It means that a reasonable jury could make that finding, doesn't it? Isn't that what the standard is?
Well, I'll accept that as the standard.
Well, tell me what it's different. I mean, this is the last time I'll pose it, but I'm just completely baffled by your refusal to acknowledge that that's the standard. I can't figure out what's different about what you're trying to say.
Well, I mean, I'll accept that as the legal standard.
Okay.
The distinction is that the trial court went through and made those determinations and determined, based on the evidence, that no reasonable juror would make those determinations, if that answers the court's question.
Okay.
I have 4 minutes left. I would like to address the county.
How do you justify, let's take the first transfer. You don't think the reasonable jury could find the first transfer was a retaliation?
No. Wendy Thomas had been told in advance that her entire unit was going to be moved. Wendy Thomas was aware they were out of space. Wendy Thomas and her entire unit were simply physically relocated to a different area where there was more space. I don't think it's reasonable, particularly since she had been told that the entire unit was being moved and the entire unit was moved.
How about the loss of the $9,000?
Again, also, as addressed in the record below, teaching assignments rotate. Wendy Thomas's teaching assignment rotated, and she, by the way, she was
it's
not...
It's a pretty good explanation, and the jury might buy it, but the jury might also say, look at the evidence and say, no, that's not why they did it. They did it because they were out together.
Well, the court below...
Why wouldn't that be a reasonable finding on their part?
Well, I think the court the court below looked at that evidence.
I know what the court below did. I'm asking you...
Because
why a reasonable jury couldn't disagree with that?
Because in that instance, Wendy Thomas was not treated disparately or differently. She was treated like all others. She was given...
Wasn't there evidence that the rotation was often postponed so that it wasn't an automatic rotation?
Yeah, the rotation certainly was not automatic. It wasn't...
But in her case, they threatened it right after she became active in the union.
Well, that's actually not true either. She became active in the union in 2009, and the teaching assignments were rotated later in 2010 and 2011. There was not the direct correlation. But there's certainly no dispute in this case that Wendy Thomas was constantly engaged in union activity, so as far as showing a direct link, that's difficult to do because nearly every action would be related to some union activity.
Well, something I wasn't clear on, maybe you can clarify for me. At some point, she made a complaint that she was being retaliated against, and there was a finding made that she was correct in one respect, but that your client declines to say what that finding was specifically. Do I have that right?
I don't think so. Preceding this litigation, Wendy Thomas filed an internal complaint that had about 13 allegations, many which were subsequently in the case. That was investigated internally over the next year, and maybe that's what you're referring
to.
Yeah,
and wasn't one of them, 12 were rejected, but one was accepted, right?
Correct.
What was that one?
I don't recall as we stand here which of in that internal affairs investigation were
accepted. Wouldn't that be relevant to a reasonable juror in assessing whether there was retaliation, that the defendant's own investigation had revealed at least one instance of retaliation?
Well, I think that would depend on what the claim was and what the charge was.
Well, that's why I'm asking what it was. But you don't know.
I don't recall the single charge as we stand here. Your Honors, I would like to at least address the cross-appeal in my last 30 seconds. And on the fees issue, the two issues we raise for this court to look at is we believe the court below did apply the wrong legal standard in finding that it would not impose fees simply because the case did not appear completely meritless at the outset. Ninth Circuit cases reject that contention. And the court also seemed to address arguments that it was only if an entire claim was frivolous and not allegations. And the Primus Auto and Ninth Circuit cases also address that that is not the standard. Nor would those standards seem to make sense or be appropriate under that standard if any single one allegation of 50 at the outset of a case were not frivolous. That would mean no matter what happened for the rest of the litigation, 1 year, 2 years, a person would be immune from fees.
Thank you.
Just briefly, Your Honor. First transfer you mentioned that he asked about, the June 2009 transfer, is not even on appeal. That one we did not appeal. The June 2009 transfer is not on appeal. That's the one. That's the first of the four involuntary transfers. It's just the second, third, and fourth ones that are on appeal with respect to the court's order. He's incorrect regarding the motivation. We have the email from Mr. Grotefend, where he specifically says in October 6, 2009, that he wants to move Wendy Thomas out of the dispatch training unit supervisor position because she's looking at things as a union representative and not as a supervisor. It's at 1876 in the record. It might have been miscited where it was in the record. Lastly, the issue of the fees. County is a bit incorrect in the sense that it's you know, since the standard is so low with respect to what can be pled as retaliatory action, that's why all kinds of things are pled in the complaint, from very severe actions to more minor actions. But the way the courts obviously look at these allegations, and this court did, this court looked at the allegations both at the onset of the litigation, when the preliminary injunction order was issued, and also at the time the summary judgment was discussed. The court looked at it at all stages, and the court found that there's a common core, that many of these allegations were part of a common core of retaliation, and that's what we pled. We had a campaign of retaliation. What we had here was a union leader. We tried at all different levels. It was an internal affairs complaint that was filed. That didn't stop the retaliation. Grievance was filed. That didn't stop the retaliation. A charge to the Public Employee Relations Board was filed. That didn't stop the retaliation. And she's the lead negotiator for the union. And so as this continued on, we filed the Section 1983 lawsuit. We did get some relief in June of 2009 because she was under a gag order during internal affairs investigations in 2011, and the gag order was making it difficult for her to feel like she wasn't violating the gag order when she was discussing and bargaining and talking to members about union activities, because in the internal affairs investigations, they were asking her about what was happening in bargaining and such. So that's why we had this preliminary injunction order that gave us, that removed the gag order and allowed her to continue to be the negotiator. Ultimately, we think that this should be returned to the jury because there's a lot of evidence that showed that a jury could use to determine that the actions were taken because of impermissible reasons. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll next hear argument in the last case on the calendar, Cruz versus City of Anaheim.